Session number 16711, Fred Welsh, reel 8.
Mr. Welsh, reel 8. You said that your main task when you first went into the island was to defend the airfield. And you, of course, were on stores at the time. What was the battalion actually doing then? Was it just a purely defensive job?
A purely defensive job right around this huge airfield. It was wired. You had to walk through barbed wire establishments to get from one company to the other. It's one thing that did happen to one officer. He got told about it and was stopped. Instead of being upright and coming up face to face, he would crawl under these wires because you had people on guard and you could open the wire, move the dunnet wire, and there was a truck. And instead of walking up to these guards, he would creep up. And little did he know that the one he'd left would phone the next one who was coming to him. And this night there was a lad on guard, and he moved the gap. So instead of this man walking in the gap, he walked into the barbed wire and got entangled. Started screaming his head off. Turned the guard out, which was turned out, plus the whole platoon. Everybody there but the sentry. When they got him out, he said, I could have been an SS man. He says, I could have been a fifth columnist. I could have done everything here. And just at that point, there was a click of a rifle pushing a bolt up the spout. Sorry, sir, he says, I've had this rifle laid on you for half an hour. And it was the sentry. And he got wrong, and the sentry was praised for his way handled the situation. He says, you wouldn't have got far, sir, I'd have shot you.
Do you remember the name of the officer?
Jackson. But he moved. We had a lot of people who... I sometimes think that they found it a bit too hard, the speed of the battalion and the way we did things, because we were a hard working division, was the 50s, in which people like General Horrocks and General Montgomery will bear out in that in many books.
Where were you sleeping?
Or just where you were in on trenches and around.
Tents, bivouacs?
No tents, no. No, we never had those. Not in Cyprus, it was comfortable to lie outside, you know, and in the dugout. I mean, I was on dugout, I laid on boxes of ammunition and what have you.
The quality of the rations that you were getting, what were they like?
They were quite good because... with the war, Cyprus was at a standstill as regard exports. And, for instance, you could get a bottle of sherry for 11 pence. You could get, I would imagine, you would get a 100 weight of oranges for a tin of corned beef. There was oil to get. There was nothing exported. You couldn't get them out. Only essentials went out, so the grapefruit, apple and grapes, and Cyprus grapes were beautiful. So if the food wasn't so good, you could buy these cheap helpers along the way, orange Jaffas, beautiful, and always somebody selling cakes. Coffees were quite good. The strange thing about Cyprus to me, again, a passing thought was, you always knew you were welcome in a cafe if you were given a glass of water. That was there. You got a glass of water like we get a cup of tea. That was to show you were welcome. And you could get a chicken dinner for a shilling and things like that. So the living was the best we had as soldiers there.
Did you get on well with the people?
Oh, yes, yes. I always remember I had a birthday there, which we went to the pictures, and we'd been in this cafe for a drink of tea, and we would go back for supper, and he had a party for me, you know. And they were that sort of people to me. Gentle, I don't know what happened to the Greeks and the Turks, just sheer hate when they started, but we never had a lot of trouble. The only trouble I ever knew, you went into nightclubs, as they call them, Kit Kats and Tip Top, Toast of New York. And when we first went, we were out on the Saturday night, and as I say, I never drank, so most of my Saturday night was getting drunks back home safely. And we went down to the Kit Kat, and the Kit Kat was upstairs, but you went upstairs on the outside of the building, up a wooden stairway. And the party left from what we were taking over was, I think it was some hussars, 5th or 6th hussars. And of course, whenever sailors or two regiments mixed, there was a fight. And I've never seen a fight like that night. This place was smashed to smithereens. It was just like a John Wayne picture, guys going out the door and over this balcony downstairs. And there was DLI, Greenhowers, East Yorks, always got stuck into these hussars, so I thought they were better than us. And, got to get them all home before the MPs got hold of them. But as I say, they could get a glass of bottle of sherry for 11 pence or get drunk on sherry. So they were drunk for days. You know, a glass of water and they were still drunk the next day.
When the British Army goes abroad, you have the problem of the ladies of ill repute, brothels.
Yes.
Was that a problem with the battalion?
Well,
VD particularly?
I was only ever in one. And I went in to get somebody because I'm afraid I was an innocent abroad. And this never affected me, but they were very dirty. Actually, I've heard whispers that it came from the Turks of the last war who put these diseased girls in the brothels for the last war to spread the disease among the British. How far it's true, I don't know. So you were warned about them very, very much. There's only one story I will tell. After Crete and Greece fell, Cyprus was the next target. So if you went out into the, from Lakatamia to Nicosia, about 6 miles, you must take your rifle. And if there was an invasion, you didn't report back, you reported to the nearest depot. But you carried your rifle. And in every pub, there was an order, don't forget your rifle. And these lads went out, Dickie Carter, Lightfoot, Tommy Mitchell, and got plastered. And everywhere Tommy Mitchell went, he saw this notice, don't forget your rifle. So at 2 o'clock on the Sunday morning, there's a rare commotion going on. These guys is coming back from Miss Nicotine, missed the last stroke and had a walk. Singing. Nobody had a rifle, except Tommy Mitchell, he had 6. Every time he'd seen a rifle, picked one up. And there were 7 of them, and everybody's rifle was there but Tommy Mitchell's. And his had been picked up by the RSM of the CMP, military police. So he was for the high jump league and got court-martialed. And he got 2 years failed punishment. And his failed punishment was running around his aerodrome after duties, not joint duties, after duties, his spare time, with all his kit full of rocks in the heat. But fortunately, there was a flap on, we had to go to Iraq, and it got nulled a little bit, and he didn't do much of it. But everybody chuckled on the court-martial. They could see this man picking a rifle up, because they noticed it. Don't forget your rifle. And he had six out of seven, and the seventh was the one he'd lost, his. And I say he got 2 years of failed punishment. Lost the rifle. He found it, like, because RSM had it. And he'd just done it on deliberate, like, you know, I never had the DC to say to the lad, as I say again, I can never work that out. It still will not go into my mind that this is fair, that instead of saying to the guy, look, mate, you've left your rifle, pick it up. But make a song and dance about it, that meant everybody had to go to court martial, time was wasted. Officers had to be called to court martial, everybody had to give their evidence, and all this man had to say, look, mate, you've left your rifle, pick it up. But no, they sneaked it out when he was there. As I say, I could never, never come to terms with that. Never understand them.
Did you get much leisure organisation in the sense of sport and swimming, this kind of thing?
No. Yeah. Went swimming about, you maybe get once, one weekend in three, you went down to Limassol and that place, and it was beautiful swimming. You could walk for 10 minutes in the sea, it was that shallow, beautiful. Of course, there was only, I think it was from Augusta, it was the only place where you could get a ship, the rest, Limassol and all the other seaside towns. I never got up to Trudis in the mountains. Of course, as I say, I never had a leave abroad. Never once. With the DLI, I never got leave. One or two got to site out of the desert, but I never got any. Never had any leave at all.
Did you stay around the airfield for the whole of the time in Cyprus?
Oh, yes, yeah. I stopped there all the time.
You didn't move elsewhere on the island?
Oh, no. I never went from place to place. They couldn't afford movement of troops. It was dangerous. The jury was on the prowl then. He was the winner, and he had to be fully alert all the time.
What happened to you then when you had to leave Cyprus? About what time would that be?
Well, it was getting into the autumn when it got word to leave within 24 hours. But I had to leave in 24 hours. And as I say again, I had to stay behind to hand over to the next ones that would come, who turned out to be an Indian division. And the battalion rushed away and went on ships to Egypt and through the Valley of the Jordan, and then got on, stopped there and got organised to go into Iraq.
So how long had they gone before you started to move? Or, in other words, how long were you in Cyprus after they'd gone?
Oh, I was in about a week. Again, we were left with no rations. Everything was done so speedily, but...
How many of the were you that stayed with you?
Just two. Just two of us. Just look after the company area and patrol it and look after the stores. Because it didn't take stores, I hadn't time.
Would there be two in each company?
Yes, two in each company. And we were fortunate. We were pretty near the officers' mess of the Freight Era. And we finally had to go over there and ask about food. Oh, they said, you can live here, don't worry about. So we lived off rough ration, which, again, were much better than ours. You know, officers' mess, just the two of us.
Did the Indians appear very quickly? After the battalion gone?
About I think they came off the boats that we got on, but they didn't get from Famagusta to the actual trenches for a week, because you've got to get organised. And they had an advance party came up, and we showed them all round, and showed them where the town was and where the guard posts were and where the good points were, the bad points, and where the stores were, signed over the stores, and just went down to Famagusta, and we sat about that, and finally a cruiser came in, a Navy cruiser, one night, and said we could get on there. But we just got on, we weren't allowed anywhere else, we just stood, because we had army boots on, you weren't allowed to walk on the decks. I never got a drink of water of them. Never got a drink of water of the Navy on that ship. I was very disappointed with that.
And was this another night journey?
Yes, night time, overnight.
Where did you land them?
I should have had all these names written down.
It wasn't Haifa, Palestine, in that area, was it?
Haifa area, that was it. Haifa, Palestine. And I would catch up with the battalion about a day before we left, to go through the Jordan Valley, which I'll never forget, and up this escarpment into this high rock, which is a barren waste. There's so many words I can describe it with. All its property is underneath in oil.
So the battalion had arrived in Palestine ahead of you, and obviously they'd have to take over some form of transport.
Yes, the service corps. The service corps did it all then, you see. You didn't have... companies didn't have the amount of vehicles we've got now. I mean, you've got a fleet of trucks that... They did the Iraq run because the RAF had a place called Habaniya in Cyprus. In Iraq, which was a halfway point. Because whenever you travelled in those places, Iraq, Iran, I suppose, the desert, the Western desert, even the Sahara desert, you had to travel to the next water point. It could be 50 miles or it could be 50 days, but you had to reach that water point. So you travelled, when you went into Iraq, you went until you came to a water point, and then you came to Habaniya, and then we arrived, went through Baghdad, and we went nearly to Kirkut and guarded the bridges for the...
Can we look at the journey in more detail? From the beginning, you said you moved off and down to the Valley of the Jordan. You said you never forget that. What exactly was it like?
Well, it was so beautifully laid out with the orange groves, which were ready to be picked, and the water, irrigation, the canals, so beautifully laid out. And you'd just come from Egypt, which is, I say, is nothing to me. I never saw much of it, but I never saw any beauty in it. With all, as I say, street vendors and dirty people, Arabs wandering about. You didn't know who was who, and crowded.
Were you travelling over a good road?
Oh, yes, it was tarmac road, yes, but the dust coming up in the back of the trucks, terrible. Day after day after day.
Were you with the stores truck, or...?
No, just I was back as an infantryman then.
Same platoon?
Same platoon, yes, 16 platoon. And you're in your own wagons.
How were you seated in the wagons?
Along the side on wooden benches with the sergeant and the corporal who commandeered the buck, which was the best, they thought. But after 2 days, they didn't want that good seat, because that's where the dust all swirled in the buck.
What distance is there between trucks on a convoy journey like this?
Well, I think about 30 yards. But a thing that's never been able to be... I've never heard it explained. It was again, you go the truck at the front is the slowest. It determines the pace. We'll say 30 mile an hour. But it turns out the guy at the back has to do about 70 to keep up with that 30, and nobody can explain this. Just the fact that you get held up and they move on 100 yards and you're losing 100 yards. So
there's a pretty strict convoy discipline.
Oh, yes, yes. Kept in line by motorcyclists. Dispatch riders up and down, keeping if they were losing the pace or losing the distance, they were supposed to keep up. But as I say, it was very hard. I mean, to get up the escarpment was round and round hairpin bends, and some good drivers, some bad drivers. And get up easy, and some made hard work. So that would be a spot where it got spread out, and the rear end would have to go as hard as it could. They were all Chevrolets, big high Chevrolet 30 tonners. And you arrived, and there was, as I say again, the coach always went first, or they were there, and your meal was ready when you got there, and your sleeping quarters were laid out, your tents. And
How were they laid out? What was there a pattern, a specific pattern?
Well, just in lines, really, company lines, and you got your dinner, and then you, again, the rifle was to clean, it was filthy. It always had to be kept spotless, your rifle. And you were just glad to walk about at night to stretch your legs. And then next morning, as I say, another thing sticks in your mind. Your whole company got in a line and walked right across the camp and picked everything up, cigarette ends, papers, matchsticks and everything. And it was left as you found it the night before. Every camp you stopped at, that ritual was carried out. Must not leave dirt about.
What time would Rivali be?
Oh, 6. Always 6 o'clock.
Breakfast then?
Yes, as soon as you got up, you got tidied up, washed and shaved, and down for your breakfast, because you run your wagons and...
You were issued with a water ration of some kind, were you?
Why, just your water bottle, that was all. That's all you got, a water
bottle. So how were you able to wash and shave?
Why, there was washing facilities at these overnight stops. Say, Habania was a proper Air Force camp. It even had that concert halls and that built. It was a proper RAF camp with structural buildings, you know.
In between, of course, you just have these overnight stops at specific points.
Yes, yes. As I say, water point.
Were you following the pipeline up?
Yes, it was always on the right, left-hand side, going up to Iraq.
Did the terrain change as you were moving through?
No, you rode up the top, and you just hit this desert, and that was it. And I mean, a lot of people, I often say, when you see a picture on here, you see tanks, they're in sand dunes about 12 foot high, they weren't knee deep in sand. I never saw any sand like that. You couldn't dig. You didn't dig trenches in the desert, you built sangers up. You didn't go down, you went up. You couldn't dig holes. Nowhere.
So when you reached the desert part of your journey, did the method of the convoy change, or was it more spread out than behind?
No, I went straight down the road all the time into Iraq.
Behind each other?
Yes, all the way to through Baghdad.
Then you reached Habinya, you said, and
yes.
Did you stay there for any
yes,
length of time?
Yes, a night. Yes, a good night there. You got.
What did they do for you?
Well, it was good rations there and a good cleansing place, you know. But as I say, you were, I don't know his name, but there was some sheikh who didn't like England, who was causing trouble, and we were supposed to be going to quell him, you know, and it really was a race to get there. So you didn't have time for any sort of niceties. You just were soldiers and you carried on.
So you carried on from the airfield. Where did you go to next on your route?
We rode through Baghdad itself.
What was that like?
Horrible. That was the biggest shock of my life, because Baghdad was the home of Ali Baba and his 40 thieves to me. And it was absolutely vile, filthy. The river was filthy. Absolutely. That was the biggest shock I had abroad, I think, Baghdad. And then we went...
Did the population, were they hostile in any way because
of the
troubles?
Well, they were, yeah. You weren't very welcoming, never in Baghdad. You were never allowed out in Baghdad.
Had you to travel in some specified way through the city?
Oh, yes, you had to be... you were warned, you must not retaliate because you would get stoned. But you must not throw them back.
And did they throw stones at
you? Oh, yeah, yeah. They were throwing stones at the troops and that, you know. And you went through. We just went through, man. We didn't stop or anything like that. Now we came to this tented camp on the hillside at near Kirkut, where the river ran, and we were on guard at the bridge all the time. And we were in khaki drill, and that was, ooh, it was winter, Christmas, bitter, bitter cold. Because on this hillside, we're on the tents, and you could not keep the water up, lying in water all the time.
Was this your final camp that you stayed at all the
time?
Yeah,
that was the well. That was our destination.
You'd have passed before that. You'd have passed through the oil area.
No, I never saw any big oil tournaments, any terminals like that. We, as I say, these.
Do you remember the name of the area that you were in at that time?
Well, just KK. We knew it as KK, Kirkut, and there was a huge river with this bridge across. And why it was guarded, the Indians used to use that route to bring supplies down to the Western Desert. Frozen, they spoke, had to hook up coats each on. Was that cold in these open trucks, leading supplies through. And they were on night and day, they were going all the time, poor lads. Sakes, I think they were with the turbans on. You never spoke to them, they never stopped. And we slept in this water. And what we did in the end, we dig a trench in the middle of our tent, and outside we built some channels, filled them with rocks, stones, pebbles, let the water run through the tent rather than on us. Got it below us. And with the extra blankets, we laid them on the floor and we slept on 8 blankets plus our own blankets. We did well. We got Major Jackson was pleased with it, actually.
How many men was there in a tent?
Section, 7 to 10. Because... I had a sister lived at Aycliffe, and for a Christmas box, she had sent money to Libby's, the canned food people, to send me a Christmas parcel. And of all the things, I got it on Christmas Eve. And it was pears, pineapples, and all sorts. And I was just opening it when Major Jackson came around. They came around with a room ration. We got a room ration there. It was so cold. The only place I ever had a room. And as I say, I've boasted about being a teetotaler, but I enjoyed my room. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Because I was sharing this parcel out by then." Oh, stop, he says. And he went and got his Dixie and he sat down and had a fruit salad, I suppose. And I got another one, funny enough, the girl next door lived, she had sent us a one. But unfortunately, she had decided, being a young girl, I needed soap. So she put a bar of Lux soap. Everything tasted Lux soap. So Even the cigarettes we use. I used to see anybody wanted deluxe players cigarette. Poor lot, I often think about it. Wasted all that money, you know, and got ruined.
8 men to a tent, and as you say, the winter was particularly cold. Were there any attempts to get heating into the tents?
Oh, no, you couldn't do that. There wasn't room. No, you had to get into bed in numbers nearly, you know. Oh, yeah, the more in the better, the warmer, you know. But I mean, the poor lad, the cook, he is cooked in a tent. And he cooked with crude oil and water. Outside his tent, up behind, he had a drip of crude oil and water to make it flow. And of course, all blackout. And he started getting a breakfast ready about 3 a.m. He was like a pitman when he came out to this place. And everything you got was tasted of this horrible oil, black oil.